Okay, so in the last class, we try to present a picture that is from a description of so-called local dancing rule. You know how the spin or string fluctuate using this local relation. So this local relation is a quantitative description of a fluctuation or dancing. From there, we can get the Hamiltonian, which whose ground states actually satisfy this dancing rule. And then, from this dancing rule, we can also calculate the property of the excitation, in particular, property of a topological excitation. So one of a topological excitation is end of string. In the last class, we demonstrate that the end of string is have carry fractional spin because there's a two type end string. One is a straight, another is a hooked. Under 360 degree rotation, these two get exchanged. And because this 360 rotation have a non-trivial action, and exchange operation have a two eigenvalue plus one minus one. So that's led to fractional spin. Okay. So maybe let me start by say, since we have a fractional spin, actually, here we do have a spin statistical theorem for some amazing reason. That is a spin 1/2 is a fermion, integer spin is boson. You know, one may wonder, you know, why we have a spin statistical theorem? Why all the spin 1/2 particles are fermionic and all integer spin particles are bosonic? Why? Well, this emerging picture actually provides the answer. You know, here we start with some kind of a qubit model. You know, spin just qubits on the lattice with a local interaction. So those Hamiltonian are local interaction with some qubit model. Then somehow fractional spin and the fermion emerge from this model in the form of a topological excitation, that is end of string. And it seems here I'm suggesting that If you follow this line of thinking, if you say all the fermion, all the fractional spin must come from the local qubit model, then maybe you can prove the theorem. We can prove the theorem that is a spin and statistics are related. So I think this is very likely. I'm not sure whether this theorem has been proven, but with this setup, I think spin and statistics are really related. So I will finish yesterday's story by just demonstrate that actually the spin 1/2 indeed represent Fermi statistics. And actually proof is very simple. Because we are thinking about statistics, we need to think about the two particles or two topological excitation. So here's two ends of string. Okay. Then we change them. Again, remember that in which direction string leave the particle is very important. We should keep that fixed. So we do that. And so that's why when we change these two, we get this kind of weird graph. That's how string configuration is. And remember that this straight line actually representing many different states, represent superposition of these states plus the state where string get wiggled, and maybe plus even we may have some extra strings and et cetera. So it's really superposition of all this. And though all those other states are obtained by these two dancing rules, either string can deform whose amplitude do not change, or string can reconnect and dance, the density don't change. So maybe let me see. If it deform very much like this, if you reconnect here, you get this. Again, then amplitude do not change. Okay. So Because this line really represents the superposition of this class of a state. So actually means that means if you do the reconnection here, we can do the reconnection here. So this graph representing a string states is the same as this graph, because these two graphs differ by a reconnection. So when you include all the fluctuations, these two graphs actually represent exactly the same states. And then we can do another reconnection here. Then this graph actually representing the same state as this graph. They just same states. So this is the magic of a quantum superposition. We can do things like that. You know, classically, this all different graph, these three graphs are really different states. But because we have superposition, they are really the same states. And once you get here, magic appears. Exchange is equivalent to 360 rotation of one particle. Okay. And that's it. That's a spin statistical theorem. So if this particle is a fermion, then the exchange gave us if the particle carries spin 1/2, the 360 rotation gave us a minus sign, and the exchange also gave us a minus sign. If the spin is integer, the 360 rotation gave us a plus 1, the exchange always also gave us plus 1. And that's it. Yes? Is this, yeah, that's a very good question. So here I just show that the exchange operation is the same as a 360 rotation operation. Because when exchange two particle, actually after some manipulation, we say exchange is the same as a twisting a particle, one particle by 360 degree. If both particle are eigenstate of angular momentum, we know that this operation gave us plus 1 or minus 1. So that means exchange also gave us plus 1 or minus 1. Just so we relate. You know, exchange gave us some kind of a phase. But the phase we obtain is same as a 360 rotation. Yeah. I think this is not, you really ask very good questions. And so I think this picture really demonstrate, it just demonstrate exchange and the 360 rotation are related. And then we can extrapolate and wave our hand and say, oh, this relation really means spin statistical theorem. And but actually, you know, is that really true? It's just a picture. You know, is that really fermions? Actually, this led to a rather deep question. You know, what do you mean a fermion? You know, what really is a fermion? And I think maybe, I don't know whether today or maybe tomorrow, we'll discuss that actually, fermion is a property of dynamics. You know, we have a bunch of particles which are hopping around on the lattice. If those particles are a collection of bosons, they have a certain dynamics, means that their Hamiltonian have some spectrum. However, if that fermion, you'll have a different spectrum. The boson fermion really have different spectrum. So somehow, this hopping Hamiltonian of a particle on the lattice in some way encode Fermi statistics. And you from this encoding, you really obtain the energy spectrum of a gas boson or gas fermion when you implement that. You know, from here, I just have a picture. You know, it's not obvious that when this particle moves around, you do get a spectrum of fermions or you get a spectrum of bosons. You know, it's not obvious. And so maybe in that picture, I think it's more clear, you know, how the Fermi statistic, how this exchange may influence the spectrum of Hamiltonian. And that's after all what we measure. You know, we have spectrum Hamiltonian, we probe this Hamiltonian, the boson Fermi have very different behavior. But this picture does have very direct connection that the exchange and the 360 rotation have very close relation. And so this relation really imply that a spin statistical theorem. Okay, so this is a so all those are pictures. So they argue this is okay. I mean, they argue that from this Dunsen rule, we can get Hamiltonian. We can also get some kind of highly non-trivial property. There's a fractional quantum number and a fractional statistics. But I will go into this a little further. Yes.
Maybe one can really show this just by replacing the left particle by this boson superposition state of a straight and Higgs state, and the right.
Yeah. Those are not ideal states, so it's not so clear. But if you're using superposition states, then do the same thing. Then you do get the minus sign.
So for both of them,
yeah, exactly. So certainly this picture is not done for ideal states, but exactly you can, yeah, you really replace the left and right by this or by this, you know, then do things. Yeah, you may get something. Actually, spin statistics, I think, apply for two dimension in a sense. Here we say spin 1/2 is a boson, spin 1 is a spin 1/2 is a Fermi, spin 1 is a boson. And later we have example, the spin may not be 1/2, may be 1/4. Then you get onion. So in 2D, so even works there, even work for onion.
Yeah, but I say spin statistics theory also works in 3D.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, this picture does apply for 3D. Yeah. For this particular case, it's applied for 3D. Okay, so let's no. So with this, let's discuss another property which I didn't really emphasize. It's how many topological excitations do we have? And then you may say, well, you may have a 2. This one, or this one. They have different statistics, maybe have a 2. But actually, this is a very interesting question. And so in this model, actually, we have a 3, not 2. So to see why we have a 3 is a little bit delicate. But let me just define this concept. You know, how many topological excitations do we have? What this concept means. We already say that the particle excitation simply means that we have energy bump. We have some excitation whose energy are localized. So that's kind of some kind of particle-like excitation. Then we introduce a concept. Some excitation are topological, others are not. What does that mean? So non-topological excitation or maybe trivial excitation really means that we can create this excitation by some kind of local operators, starting from the ground states. So those ground states whose energy are uniform. Then we do something to this region, you know, destroy the correlation, cause some energy, then we create some kind of energy bump. So this is a typical way to create excitation, particle-like excitation. It's just a do something locally, you cause some energy, then you have something. Okay. However, from this point you can see that this end of string station is very special. The energy is like this, it's like a bump. But we cannot create such thing using some any local operator. So this gave us concept, this end of string is non-local or topological in some sense. So that's concept. So any excitation which cannot be created by any particle-like excitation or localized energy bump cannot be created by any local operator, then we say this extension is a topological. We can bring this concept even further. We say that suppose we already have some quasi-particle, we already have some bump. Okay. Then we apply local operator. Okay. Then we say that this extension with some kind of local, you know, local destruction or local modification would be the similar because the difference is not topological. The difference is only local. So we say excitation plus some local perturbation is equivalent to the original excitation. So we define some kind of equivalence class. We say the two bump, if they only differ by some kind of local operator, we say, okay, they are equivalent. And so using this equivalence relation, we can build the equivalence class of a particle excitation. And then the number of equivalence class is what we call the number of a topological type. So how many topological excitation do we have? Okay. And we'll go back to this problem. But I want to claim that for the Turok-Kolb model, the number of topological type is equal to 4. These 4 include the trivial type, means one of the type is just local excitation. Then 3 type of non-trivial topological excitation. So it means so there are 3 kinds of a bump. They cannot deform into each other by local operator. And they cannot deform to the ground state by local operator. Okay. And the reason I talk about this because there's an amazing property. Is that we can somehow obtain, because you can see to calculate types, seems very difficult. You have to examine all the excitation whose energy are local. Then to see, are they connected by this arbitrary local operator and make them, group them together, and then how many types. It seems it's almost impossible to do something. Although conceptually can define that, in practice, it's very hard to do. But there's an amazing relation is that the number of a topological type is equal to number of one state degeneracy. On torus. So therefore, we don't need to really do this. This is some amazing relation in topological quantum field theory. That is, you just put your system on a torus and measure, and because this system have energy gap. But however, on a torus, the spectrum looks like this. There's a fourfold degeneracy, and then there's continuum. So this 4 is this 4. Okay. I don't know how to prove this. I just say this is some kind of mathematical fact, a mystery to me. Yes?
Can you put the number of topological paths in concrete terms?
Huh?
Can you put the statement number of topological paths in concrete terms?
Means this. I think we need to define this equivalence relation. Mm-hmm. That is, if two quasi-particle-like excitation, they differ by some kind of local operator, means you can change this state by applying some local operator to another state. Then these two states are regarded as an equivalent type. Once you define this equivalence relation, then you can define so-called equivalence class. You know, you can group all these local excitations together. So each group, these local excitations are all connected by these local operators. But however, in different group, they cannot be connected. Then you ask, how many groups do we have? And so the answer for this toroidal model length is a 4 group. And it's since defining this is very difficult, and really calculate this, measure this, it's more difficult. But actually, there's a trick. You can just measure ground state degeneracy on the torus. Then you get it. And as I mentioned that, this model is exact soluble. This model is exact soluble. So we should be able to compute the ground state degeneracy on a torus. So actually, that's why we are interested in the computing ground state degeneracy on a torus, because it tells us how many types of topological excitation do we have. Yes?
How do we know beforehand to choose a torus, or you know, we can choose two holes, or how do we know if we need a torus there?
Yeah, so. Okay, since so this looks mysterious, you know, why torus relate to this? So maybe I give some kind of argument. So when you have this a topological excitation, then you can create two topological excitation in pairs. You cannot create one alone, but you can create two. You start with one state, you create a pair, then drag another state around, all the way around. Then it's like you kind of insert this loop of a string, you know, along the torus. And certainly, you can do this with different type. You know, if it's another type, you can do the same thing. Then this way you generate different degeneracy. So this is kind of, and it's not proof, but this kind of picture link, you know, number of types to number for degeneracy. That's one picture. Another picture is the following. We start with a sphere with two holes. Now, two holes is a defect. And maybe we can put some kind of these two holes could be two quasi-particles, you know. And then we add a handle. We kind of glue these two holes together. When you put a different quasi-particle or different topological type in the two holes, when you glue them together, then the state and the torus in the resulting torus are different. So there's some picture that somehow this particle type running through the handle. The different way a particle runs through the handle gives a different degeneracy. So those are some kind of intuitive picture to say how number of types and ground degeneracy are related. Yeah. And I think later there are even more picture like that. But yeah, I don't have a very deep understanding why is this. I just say this is a. We think this is true. Okay, so that's why we want to calculate the ground state degeneracy on the torus. And how do we do that for this model? So let's do some counting. This model is on the honeycomb lattice. So suppose you have n cells with a periodic boundary condition. Then how many sites do we have? And I think we have three n cell site. The number of site is 3n. So n site, n spin, maybe they call it spin. The number of spin is 3 times n cell. Because you know, each hexagon is a cell. So each hexagon have six spins, but each spin is shared by two hexagons. So each one only counts as half. So that's how I count. And okay, so that means the dimension of Hilbert space, you know, the dimension of Hilbert space is really 2 to the 3 times n cell, the total dimension of Hilbert space. Okay. And then we have this, that's one, let me see. Okay. Then we mentioned that we have this, we have these two operators. So maybe let's using this, using the Q. So we call this one is a Q, this one is a F. Then we say that the QI can be plus minus 1, and FP can be plus minus 1. Because they, so this, by assigning QI FP to be plus minus 1, we can label all these states. Actually, we try to use this to label all the states, because we're using the common eigenstates of Q and P to label all the states in Hilbert space. We try to do that. Okay, because they commute, so we can use their common eigenstate to label that. So for the Q, give us total how many label? Give us 2 to the 3, sorry, 2 n cell label. Because the Q label live on the vertex. The Q label live on the vertex. Okay. And then we have a number of vertex is twice as the number of cells, number of unit cell. So basically it's just a number of vertex. Okay. And F label give us 2 to the n cell. Because F act on the hexagon, just a number of cell. That's a perfect, you know, these two together, this time it's just this. So it looks like plus minus sign for Q and the plus minus one for F totally label all the state in the Hilbert space with one-to-one correspondence. Okay. But actually it's not that perfect. And because we have the constraint, and remember, the product of all the Q equal to 1, and the product of all the F equal to 1. So the claim that Q and F are totally independent is a lie. It's not quite true. But this is not a big lie. We're only missing one global constraint. So this means the number for minus 1 should be even. Just otherwise, it's totally arbitrary. So therefore, the independent label for Q actually is a factor 2 less than what we expected. And the same thing for the F is a factor 2 less. OK. So then we have something a little bit strange. The F and the Q could not label all the states, but they differ by factor 4. Okay. But however, energy, look at it. Energy only depends on F and Q. Okay. So this really means that the following. So after collecting all this information, we get the following picture. That F and Q do not label all the states. So that means there are 4 states have the same F and Q, you know. So for every F and Q, actually there's a 4-fold degeneracy. And then including this 4-fold degeneracy and plus this all different plus label, then we recover the total dimensional Hilbert space. So for every F and Q, we have 4-fold degeneracy. And because energy only depends on this eigenvalue of F and Q, so this 4 state with the same F and Q would have same energy. So this is why we say, okay, this is a 4. Okay. So using this, you know, in the tutorial section yesterday, we considered another model where on each, we have a square model, where on each square we have a sigma x, sigma y, sigma x, sigma z, maybe, sigma x, sigma z interaction. So on each square we have four spin interaction. So we call this f. Okay. And again here, the f totally commute between each other. So we can use in a similar thing. So there the spin live on the side. So total number of Hilbert space dimension is equal to 2 to the n cell. Okay. Then the number of constraint f equal to plus minus 1 also gave us a 2 to the n cell label. Okay. But however, there's constraints. And the constraint is that on the even plaquette, the product of Fp equal to 1. And also on the odd plaquette, Fp equal to 1. So here we have a lattice. And we have this even odd plaquette. So the shaded one are even plaquette and shaded one is odd plaquette. Amazingly, that's certainly multiplication for all Fp equal to 1. But we have a bigger constraint. We have two independent constraints. The product of Fp of those four spins on even plaquette only already gave us 1. And the odd plaquette only also gave us 1. So actually, we have two constraints. So these two constraints gave a total reduction factor of 4. So that's a fourfold degeneracy. But this is true only on the even by even lattice. It's kind of amazing, even by even lattice. Then on even by odd lattice, then we can no longer distinguish even odd plaquette, because locally we have even odd, but when you go around it, even may became odd, odd may become even. So therefore, when you have even by odd lattice on the even by odd lattice, then we only have one constraint. That's mean product of all the Fp equal to 1. So actually, the number of constraints are different, amazingly. So in that case, on even by odd, we don't have a factor 2 reduction. And this confused me a lot, actually, when I do this. I just say, that's two topological types or four topological types. And so it turns out the answer is, the answer is very tricky, actually. The real answer is that on even by even lattice, there's four types. On even by odd lattice, there's two types. You see how that can be? Because on even by odd lattice, moving one type all the way around the torus, this type will become another one. So originally, there's two different types which are distinct. But on even by odd lattice, moving one around another all the way around the torus actually became the other type. So you cannot really distinguish the two types on the even by odd lattice for some amazing reason. But this will, yeah. But I don't think we'll go into this. But this is but from this, I just want to demonstrate that this the Gronsk degeneracy is a very, very important property. And so actually, the Gronsk degeneracy is topological. It's actually one of the topological invariants you can use to define topological order. You know, you mentioned that topological order as a concept should be defined by something measurable. Certainly, number of a topological type is something you can use to define non-trivial topological order. But it's very hard to measure. Gronsk degeneracy is much easier. As it related, it's itself is topological invariant, means that the Gronsk degeneracy remain to be full, even when you include arbitrary perturbation to the Hamiltonian. You cannot change that. And so therefore, we can use Gronsk degeneracy to define topological order. So actually, that's what happened historically. So we discovered this topological stability of the Gronsk degeneracy. Then we use this to define the concept of a topological order. So that's what happens here. Okay, so this is a story about the toroidal model. Any other questions? Yeah.
When you go to the
Yes.
How do you keep a distinction between even lattice and even odd lattice when, you know, infinity and infinity
That's
plus
right.
one are kind of the same?
That's a very, very good question. So actually, that's one thing I prefer, one reason to like this one. This definition is kind of local. You know, you can do this locally to see how many types. Even for very, very large system, you don't need to worry about boundary. Okay. And somehow, this local property are linked to the degeneracy and the torus. And this is, again, really very, very good question. Because, you know, when we first present these results, actually, your question is your first question. This may not be do not look like a thermodynamical property. It's like a boundary condition, some finite size effect. So it should have nothing to do with the phase of matter. Yeah. And indeed, I totally agree with you. You know, why this thermodynamical property? Okay. But however, the fact that this degeneracy is robust against arbitrary perturbation, this make it a thermodynamical property. Because this degeneracy do not depend on the perturbation of Hamiltonian. So it's a so-called universal property. That is, when you deform the Hamiltonian arbitrarily, we still have the same degeneracy. So this number don't change for a class of states. We can claim those class states are similar, they belong to the same phase. When you change the Hamiltonian too much, degeneracy changes. Then we say there's a phase transition. Another degeneracy just label another states. So actually, degeneracy became other parameter. It's certainly non-local. It's something depend on topology of a space, but they do play a role other parameter. If you do this fixed boundary condition, measure degeneracy, the degeneracy have a jump across phase transition. And then that's how you'll see phase and phase transition. Degeneracy can jump, have two ways to jump. One is this energy gap close and reopen again. When they reopen, you left different number of states behind, so the degeneracy can change. That's one way. So this represents the continuous transition. Another way degeneracy can change is that, so let's assume this is a parameter space, some kind of G. And then there's so you may have this level crossing. You know, in this region, there are twofold degeneracy. When you're changing parameter, this twofold degeneracy crosses fourfold degeneracy. In this region, the ground state have fourfold degeneracy. This level crossing, but this represents the first order phase transition. So usually, the degeneracy can change in these two ways. And in both cases, we go through a phase transition. And so it's because robustness, that's a key. Because degeneracy are robust against arbitrary perturbation, so it's OK to use degeneracy to label a phase and to even define a phase. And here, we use degeneracy to define the concept of topological order, basically. Yes?
So I was thinking if you have a toric lattice with an even times odd number of sides, then you can think of it as the two radii of the torus being different. So when you take the thermodynamic limit, then you still preserve that topological property of the torus.
So what's the question again? So you have a torus?
If you have an even times odd number of sides, then you can think of it as having a torus with different radius.
Okay, yeah.
And then so when you take the continual limit, then you
very good question. So the splitting of the state is actually e to the minus L over C. L is this radius you mentioned. But however, it's maybe the smaller one, the smaller radius. Okay. So if you take some limit where only one radius goes to infinity, another radius do not go to infinity, then in fact, the splitting would remain to be finite. that do not go to zero. So degeneracy is defined in the thermal limit. I mean, when both radii go to infinity, actually this is a splitting getting approach to zero. That's how we define degeneracy. And this requires both radii go to infinity. If only one radii go to infinity, maybe only two levels getting close, another two is not getting close. Or maybe the different pattern. And then it's very different. Because in that particular thermodynamic limit of only one radius go to infinity, actually the level splitting do not go to zero. So they are not degenerate in the thermodynamic limit. So that's a very different question. So actually in that case, the problem became a one dimensional problem. And there's no topological order in one dimension. That's right. If both radii go to infinity, even with very different rates, then this will go to zero. That is okay. You know, say maybe one radii go to infinity in a log rate, another go to like exponential rate. So the torus will have very elongated shape. But as long as both radii are infinity, then this degeneracy go to zero. Or this split go to zero, you can define degeneracy with no ambiguity. Yeah. So other questions? Yeah. Yeah.
So you mentioned that the front state degeneracy is robust against perturbation and this is the thermal dynamics.
Yes.
How does it relate to angles?
Yeah, maybe I'm going to discuss string operator probably tomorrow, and after that, this stability and this relation may be more clear. Yeah, okay.
I was just thinking that the low energy effective filter expression, at least in state,
yeah.
That just corresponds to the same filter in different boundary conditions, essentially? Or
what do you mean, two states? You mean these states or these states?
I mean, like, because on the latitude of even up. So when you say continuum limit and filter, it seems to.
Okay. Yeah, this actually became a research project, actually. So what really happened here is the following. Our theory have a translation symmetry. However, the translation symmetry operation is realized in field theory as in a highly non-trivial way. So actually, in this particular case, we have a two kind of field. The effective theory have two kind of field. And the translation by one lattice spacing exchange two field. That's a non-trivial realization of a translation symmetry in the field theory. And somehow, on the even boundary condition, these two fields just have a periodic boundary condition. Okay. But on the even by odd boundary condition, in the field theory, you should have a non-trivial boundary condition where the two fields should exchange, then gloom back. So phi 1 go to phi 2, phi 2 go to phi 1. And this non-trivial boundary condition in field theory can produce exactly this ground state degeneracy with dependence on even odd dependence. And in this particular model, this problem is solved. But this will demonstrate a principle that is the symmetry may act in a very non-trivial way in the field theory. And to study how symmetry act in this case topological field theory is a current interest. It's a study how symmetry can be combined with topological order in a legal way. Yeah. So this is a really very active current interest, which can be approached in this fashion. Yeah. So this phenomena describe how the translation symmetry interact with a topological order in this particular model. Yeah. Okay, let me just continue to another example. So let me see. I need to bring that down. So here I describe one dancing pattern, which is we go from here to particle to boson and fermion, to spin 1/2 and to boson and fermion. So next we try to change the dancing pattern. You know, when you have a dancing pattern, there should be many different ways of dancing pattern. So how do you change dancing pattern? So here I want to say that the coefficient here actually change dancing pattern. Okay. One way to modify dancing pattern is to add a minus sign here. You say, what do you mean by adding minus sign here? Well, when you add the minus sign, it really means falling. So here, this is on the square. Here we say the string only go to one unit cell. If you just add one unit cell, you know, just one square, or maybe one hexagon, you know, then you change minus sign. Suddenly, if a string default increase error by two unit cell, then there's no minus sign. So for the elementary one, if you add one unit cell, just enlarge the error by one unit cell, you get a minus sign. So this is one way to changing dancing pattern. And this way can be implemented very easily by changing sign here. If you changing sign here, actually the wave function is no longer just equal with the superposition of all the strings. Actually, the wave function, when you're changing this, the wave function would have became, okay. The wave function no longer equal to 1, but equal to minus 1 times the area enclosed by all the strings. If all the strings enclose even area, this will be plus 1. If all the string enclose odd area, it will be equal to minus 1. Okay. So this change actually describes a different phase, actually. And so this kind of a wave function, and the wave function which just the string just equal to 1, these two wave functions belong to different class. Provide that we do not break translation symmetry. So if you have translation symmetry, these two wave functions belong to different class. Okay. But this is not what we are going to do. So this is a one way to have a different dancing pattern. And but here I want to do something more topological. We change the sign here. Okay. If change the sign here, again it's changing the wave function. So originally the wave function just equal to 1. But when you change the sign here, it's become minus 1 raised to a number of loops. You know, how do you see that? Well, so suppose that here we have a state with one loop. If you do reconnection, then state became two loops. So actually, there's something interesting. Every reconnection moves, changing number loop by 1, either plus 1 or minus 1. They always change number loop by 1. So now you say that if a reconnection gives you minus 1, so that means when number loop changing by 1, then the wave function changing sign. So that's why the total, this dancing pattern gives you this wave function. The wave function actually is a minus 1 raised power to number of loops. So then you change the dancing pattern. Okay. And when you change the dancing pattern, then you say, okay, the Hamiltonian changes. So let's go to discuss Hamiltonian later. And but the statistics also changes. And the fractional spin also changes. So again, this is a good demonstration that the topological property, such like the fractional spin or fractional statistics, is determined by the dancing rules. And the dancing rule certainly is just quantitative description of an entanglement. So I'm using this local relation to describe entanglement. So changing this sign here is a way to modify the entanglement of a ground state. We try to say the wave function have this minus 1 to numbers loops. This wave function have a different pattern entanglement. And this different pattern entanglement actually have a topological consequence, give us different fractional spin and the fractional statistics. So how that works? Well, we still try to do this 360 rotation. But now these string states are slightly modified. Again, using the first rule, these two still have same amplitude. But from here, we have a reconnection. Reconnection gives us a minus sign. So actually, this straight line representing different wave function, representing this kind of wave function, sometimes we have a minus sign. OK. Then with this understanding, then we just do what we did before. The straight end of string after 360 rotation gave us a hooked one. And the hooked one actually equal to the other hooked one with a minus sign. Because these two differ by a reconnection move. And then we, after this identification, we do this 360 rotation, and that gave us a straight one, and also with a minus sign. So therefore, in the basis where straight one and the hooked one, in this basis, then the R360 became 1 minus 1. So there's a one of them is a minus. Still exchanging the two, but one exchange carry actual minus sign. And for this particular case, we find its eigenvalue, this can be diagonalized, eigenvalue became I minus I. So therefore, this, I think, maybe this plus I, I could make a minus sign error. So this plus I, straight plus I hooked one, maybe have a R60 equal to I. And this one may have R60 equal to minus I. So this one may have a spin quarter. And this one may have a spin minus quarter. So this quarter spin appears. Yeah. And since quarter spin means a 360 rotation give us phase I, so that means exchanging this particle give us I or minus I, that's a Samian. Something statistic between boson and the fermion. Okay. So this is So this demonstrates, you know, how modification of Dunsen rule gave us different statistics. Okay. So as a last topic, so let me here and demonstrate that actually this kind of wave function, again, or this kind of Dunsen rule. Again, can be implemented by a local Hamiltonian. But the local Hamiltonian are a little bit complicated. Again, have same structure as before. You know, before we have this Q term. So this is what we call the QI term. And this we call this FP term. OK. We have two terms. And the Hamiltonian, we should realize this kind of a Dunsen rule or wave function is the same thing. It has the same structure. There's a Q term and there's F term. Okay. And so the Q term is same as before. It's just a product of a sigma z. So this is I. You product sigma z on these three neighboring sides of this vertex I. It's same as before. And F term is almost same as before. You know, if you only keep the first part, then this is the previous F term. It just flip spins. So this edge of P, P is plaquette. So this is P is plaquette. So edge means you have six edge. And this plaquette have a six edge. So this edge. So that's product of a sigma x on this six side for this six spin. So that part, the first part is same as before. We just flip spin and add a little bit of loop. But here, we modify, we have the additional modification in the next term, is a modification. So this modification is, how to think of this modification is following. What we try to do is that we may change the sign of this. Maybe, so you remember, this operator just add a loop. And we say, if you add a loop, we may change the sign. So if you add a loop with a minus sign. So one way to think, maybe we can just move for the minus sign here. That's a way to do things. So maybe wonder if I don't forget this part. If you just change the minus sign, can we achieve this? The answer is no, we don't achieve this. But we do something. If you change the sign there, what happens is that every time you add a loop of one unit cell, you get a minus sign. So what you achieve with the minus sign there is you multiply wave function minus one to the area, the other one. If you change the minus sign here, you make this kind of modification. The sign depends on area of loops, not depend on number of loops. So it's a little bit tricky how to design the wave function or a Hamiltonian so that the sign of wave function depends on number of loops, not depend on area loop. Area loop is easy. We just change the sign here. We can obtain the wave function whose sign oscillates between even area and odd area. But to number loop is a little non-trivial. But here, this operator you can view as a kind of like adding a sign. But we can do plus sign or minus sign. And either plus or minus depend on the spin on the legs. You know, so those are legs. The legs of this plaquette. I have six legs. So the spin here can be up and down. Dependent spin is up and down here on the legs. This sign of adding a loop can be plus or minus. So we do this kind of thing. So actually, this operator only depends on sigma z. It's just a face. And actually, this is a sign. I will explain that in a moment. This is actually a sign. So with this operator, we just say, we still add loops. But sometimes when you add a loop, we have a minus sign. Sometimes we don't have minus sign. Depending on what the spin configuration on these six legs. So that's a way to do it. And this would work. So let's try to examine this. So first I want to say that this operator have two values, zero or one. You know, if a spin is up, this is zero, spin down, this is be one. Just zero or one. Okay. So let's I think I should have a minus sign here. Actually, I should have a minus sign here. Okay. So let's consider initially spin all up. If spin all up, this cancels, this just equal to zero, so no phase. If spin all up, we add the loop with a minus one. Okay. So this corresponds to the following relation. With one small loop, we just compare to nothing, we have minus one. So if you add a small loop, we get a minus one. Okay. Then we can consider a situation that initially we have a string here. Suppose we have a string here. So those are down. Then we try to add a loop here. The interesting to see that in this case, there's a two leg with down spin. Two leg with down spin. So therefore, this phase factor in this case gave us I square. You know, each down spin gave us I. So this is actually equal to minus one, gave us additional minus one. So this minus one cancel this minus one. So therefore, when we already have a string like this, when you add another string here, actually, we don't change the sign. There's no sign change. And so again, you know, this string just deform into the bigger one. So the number of loops do not change. Then if you have another configuration, suppose initially we have this. In this case, when we add a loop here, we actually do the reconnection. You know, this kind of string became this kind of string. We have reconnection. But in this, if initially we have this kind of string, then we have a full downspin on the legs. So this phase factor became I to the fourth power, became plus one. And the reconnection gave us a minus one. So basically you can play around. You can assume other things. You know, as long as a string, there's no string end. Certainly, if a string end here, there's some more complication. As long as U is very big, so U enforce the string always closed, no end. As long as on a closed string subspace, this operator behave very nicely. And this factor, we all have even number of downspin in the legs. So this factor, although we have I here, this actually is real. This whole factor just either plus one, minus one. Okay. And so this is really, this demonstrates that, well, it works. You know, this particular Hamiltonian really realize this kind of a dancing. And this different dancing, they have different topological order because they have even different spin, different statistics. So this dancing rule describes a different topological order. And so then, and this different topological order realized by a different Hamiltonian. And this can be generalized in a sense, you know, here we have string only have one type. You make it a situation where you have many types of string, like a type one, type two, type three string, you know, all these different string. And then this amplitude here and here can be complicated, can be matrix or something. You can using this idea to generalize this to a very complicated theory with a and string may also branch, you know, things like that. And but this idea is still the same. If you go that way, what you end up? You end up with the so-called tensor category theory. So this tensor category theory became a mathematical foundation for this type of a topological order. So what I describe here, this two dancing rule, is just two simplest example of a tensor category theory. But this can be generalized. And certainly we will not go there, but I just want to say that, yeah, the whole thing would kind of explode into a very big mathematical topic. And also very interesting topic. So it's we know that to describe a symmetry breaking, we need to introduce group theory into physics. And here, to describe entanglement, we need to introduce tensor category into physics. So it's possible that tensor category maybe is a mathematical language to describe entanglement. Or maybe not, we don't know actually. At least tensor category are relevant in some sense. Whether it provides a complete language for the entanglement or not is not so clear at the moment. So in the next class, we'll develop this further. You know, so far we developed a lot of concept and draw a lot of pictures. So maybe next class, we'll introduce a string operator. And using string operator, we can understand this degeneracy and a topological type, and also rederive these statistics in a more rigorous way. Yeah. So string operator is also very important. So that will be the topic of next class. Yes?
Just one quick question. Suppose we change it to be minus sign of the 2 to the power area, does that represent a new topological
order? Very good question. The answer is no. And this depend on the this require the translation symmetry. Yeah. So it's a correspond to so-called symmetry enhanced topological order. It's a if you have a symmetry, then this minor sign matters. If Hamiltonian don't have a symmetry, then it doesn't matter because you could have a following case that the string on some kind of even bound are favored, and string on all the bound are not favored. So you could have a situation that all the string with odd area have a small amplitude, have small weight, and all string with even area have a bigger weight, and that dominate. So that'd be same as all the signs same, yeah. But when you have translation symmetry, and then this sign chain would give you different so-called symmetry enhanced topology order, different phase with a symmetry. Yeah. Yes.
So we have two spin 1-4 particles, but why not one spin 1-4 and 3-4?
Hmm?
If I look at the eigenvalues, I would have guessed 1/4 and 3/4 instead of 2 times 1/4.
It's the same minus 1/4 is the same as 3/4.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry, it's minus 1/4 because there's a dash. So this is a dash, not a minus sign. Okay, yeah. Tomorrow we'll decide string operator, yeah.